is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize our true rank in nature.
Good morning. So lately I've been looking at or studying myself what are called the five wisdoms, and there's in Buddhism, one of the things that's always been difficult for me in Tibetan Buddhism especially, but also earlier Indian Buddhism, is it's very complex. I mean, it's not like Zen, where things are quite simplified. And there's all of these lists of things, like there's five of these, three of these, 15 of those, 110 or 101 of something else. And usually it's a Sanskrit word describing each of the 110 things and a long amount of explanation about what that is. I mean, I remember years ago seeing this one book, and I wish I actually had bought this book, but I was looking at it in a bookstore. And it was a book about early Indian Buddhism, or it might have even been Hindu, but I think it was early Buddhist. And it described all of these mind states that a person who's practicing meditation goes through, and there were over 100 of them. And they were all very carefully elucidated, and there was a Sanskrit word for each of them. So I'm going to give you a few Sanskrit words this morning. But just as a general background as to what we're talking about here, there are what are called five wisdoms, and these five wisdoms are considered understandings that someone who is awakened or is pretty deeply awakened has, a way of approaching the practice. So the five wisdoms are the wisdom of suchness or dharmadhatu, the wisdom of mirror-like awareness, which is the one we'll be focusing on today. The wisdom of awareness of sameness, which is the third one. The fourth one is the wisdom of investigative awareness. And the fifth one is the wisdom of accomplishing activities. So it's possible that I'll be talking about others in the future, but the second one is called Adarsa Jhana. That's the Sanskrit term, which is the wisdom of mirror-like awareness, devoid of all dualistic thoughts and ever united with its content, as a mirror is with its reflections. So these five wisdoms are considered to be what arise when the five poisons, another list of things, are transcended or seen through. And here are the five poisons. They'll be a lot more familiar to you, I'm sure. They're familiar to every human, hopefully. The five poisons are desire, anger, delusion or ignorance, pride, and jealousy. And actually, in the Zen school, they've shortened it to three poisons, but, you know, we have the five here. So these are basically all the things that get in our way in spiritual practice or in relationships or in anything, really, is desire, anger, delusion, pride, and jealousy. And you see these same themes repeated in all different religions, too. It's not just a Buddhist thing. So before I start more getting into this, I'd like to read something by Andrew Olensky. He's a Buddhist commentator and a mindfulness teacher, very well known, in talking about this second wisdom, or the wisdom of mirror-like awareness. He says, "Mind is thus neither the source of light like a shining sun, nor the reflected light of something greater like the moon, but a shimmering pool of contingent potential, capable of reflecting sun, moon, and any other object that happens to dance upon its surface. Its function is more important than its essence, and is influenced significantly by the nature of what gets stirred into its pristine waters." And this is commenting on one of the early Buddhist sutras. It's called the Anguttara Nikaya, which is one of the early discourses of the Buddha. So again, what I've always liked about Zen practice, and that my personal approach to it anyway, it has been to try and simplify these seemingly exotic notions that we find in Sanskrit and in Buddhist texts into ways in which we can relate to it in our everyday life. And if you read, if you've ever attempted to read, and I say attempted in my own case because I've never been able to get through any of the really long Buddhist sutras personally, the long ones are intense. I mean, they are long and they're repetitious and they involve a lot of very esoteric notions that are hard to grasp, hard to understand. So the Zen school, I think, was somewhat of a, it was somewhat of a counter to that kind of really complex, complex way of practicing or studying Buddhism. And in terms of this particular notion of the mirror-like awareness, I think it's really a powerful thing when we start understanding what it, how it functions and what it's about. It's something I've looked at for a long time, but recently it's something that I've looked at a lot more carefully, and I realized that there were things I was missing. So the way I look at this particular wisdom of mirror-like awareness is, if we, and I've talked about this a little bit before, but if we imagine awareness itself or consciousness itself being like a mirror, it's not a perfect analogy, but it's a pretty good one in terms of looking at how this works in our actual life. So if we're standing in front of a big mirror, like if you've ever been in a studio, like a yoga studio or something, where there's a giant mirror, whatever you bring in front of that mirror is what you see. Exclusively, you know. The mirror is does not judge what comes in front of it. The function of the mirror, which is what Olensky was saying, is why the function is so important in this particular case rather than the essence, is the function of the mirror is to reflect whatever's in front of it. And so if you bring an ice cream cone, it'll show you an ice cream cone. If you bring a mallet or a hammer, it'll show you a hammer. If you don't bring anything, it'll just be you. And it'll show an image of you based on what's actually there, which may be not be how you view yourself, in case you've ever noticed. So that should tell us something. Simple everyday thing, you step in front of the mirror, you go, oh my God, I really look like that? Am I really that old? I'm talking about myself. Do I really look like that? Yeah, at least in the mirror you do. It's just reflecting what's in front of it, and our ideas are always interposed or layered on top of reality, of course. Reality is just what is, and then our ideas are the things we think about what is. It's added stuff. Sometimes valuable added stuff, sometimes neutral added stuff, sometimes destructive added stuff. Destructive meaning destructive to our peace and well-being, and maybe the peace and well-being of others too. So if we view that consciousness as this mirror, as a mirror-like state, then it implies something really, really powerful if you look at it, which is, who is it that's responsible for what we experience in any given instance? Us, right? And us 100%, not even 99%, because we're the ones bringing whatever we've got, whatever we're dragging around, you know, like Linus and his smelly blanket, you know, whatever smelly blanket we're dragging around, that's what'll show up in front of the mirror. And by the way, the mirror in this case is, it isn't necessarily just a disembodied thing. Other people can be that mirror. You know, life situations can be the mirror. So consciousness itself, everything is imbued with this consciousness that they're talking about, this mirror-like quality, provided we're viewing it that, provided we're able to see it that way. So when we step in front of any situation, what are we bringing to that situation? And this has been my koan as of late, and it's been really a valuable practice for me to just say to myself, what am I bringing here right in this moment? So whenever I sit down and meditate, I ask myself, what are you bringing right now? What have you dragged along? And usually, always, actually, there's something. Like this morning, it always amuses me how in a half-hour sitting you can go through being pissed off, being blissful, being whatever. You'll probably have a whole universe of things happen in one half-hour meditation. Angry, maybe. Pleased. Planning for what you're going to do later today or tomorrow or a week from now. Or, you know, you don't even want to know what I usually think about. Well, you might. So I'll tell you. Even if you don't, you're going to find out. A lot of times I will plan my next fishing trip. And like, because where I'm going to go depends what tackle I'm going to need, what fishing outfits. I've got like 20 of them. So, I mean, for the average person, they would go, this guy's an idiot. But that's, and all of a sudden I'll realize I'm planning out the next friggin' fishing trip. And I'll go, wait, stop. You can do that later. This is what are you bringing in this moment? Well, you're bringing some potential fishing trip, which probably will never happen exactly like that, because you don't know what the conditions are going to be like a week from now. That determines the fishing trip. So we all do this, but we're often not aware. We're often not aware of everything we're bringing. And maybe we're never aware 100% everything we're bringing. But as we become more mindful of how and why we do things, and this is where mindfulness is a very important aspect of this particular practice. I think mindfulness is inherent in every practice, to be honest. But in this particular practice, we have to be mindful of what I'm bringing. And much of what we're bringing is not conscious in many cases. So it's one thing to be aware of planning the fishing trip or anger about something that someone did, you know, months ago or years ago that's all of a sudden popping up in this particular half hour for we know not what reason necessarily. There are the unconscious agendas that we bring to a given moment which can powerfully influence what's happening in that moment, because all that moment does, all that consciousness does, is just reflect back what we're bringing. No judgment involved. So this isn't saying that anything we bring is bad or good necessarily. That's up to the individual to determine, is this valuable or not valuable? I don't even like using good and bad. I like using skillful and unskillful. Is it skillful in this moment or is it unskillful in this moment? Now, you may choose to do something in a given moment or approach something in a given moment that's an unskillful thing that you even realize is unskillful for some other reason, you know. But it's up to us to determine the value of a given what we're bringing, but the mirror itself just reflects whatever's going on. So the more we can embrace this state of this mirror-like quality, we realize it's not a matter of good or bad what we're bringing, just that we're bringing stuff. And what we're bringing often presages the experience. Very simple to see in our relationships. If we're angry with someone and we're bringing that to that moment, then that anger is reflected back to ourselves. It causes us suffering, and then it often is picked up by the other person. Either if it's an obvious display of anger, they'll pick it up, of course. Sometimes if it's a passive-aggressive display of anger, they'll also pick it up, especially if it's a woman, by the way. Women are very good at picking up passive-aggressive stuff. Men, not so great in my experience. But if you're dealing with a woman and you're a man and you're angry, they'll definitely pick it up. And if they're smart, they'll say, you know, don't come at me with that passive-aggressive stuff. Yes. And maybe you'll learn something. So if we're hiding our anger, then what is shown in the mirror is passive-aggressive behavior, because we don't want to be known as angry, or we don't view ourselves as angry, but really there's anger there. And so it comes out. It's reflected. It's reflected back towards us and towards everything else. So the more we can embrace this quality of realizing that there's no, in any given instant, what we're experiencing is simply what we're bringing. Now, we're not the only one participating in the moment. Like, for instance, in this particular room, there's however many people are out here, and there's me speaking, and so my experience is including all of you. So obviously I can't, I'm not creating the fact that Dave's sitting there, but my viewpoint of him and my what I'm bringing to my relationship with him and to this talk in this given moment is conditioning how, to some extent, how he's viewing me and how I'm viewing myself and what our relationship is. So that's what I'm talking about. We're talking about an inner view. And so imagine if we could see things this way in any given moment. This, the mirror, which is always there, is reflecting what we're bringing. And let's apply it to meditation, for instance. So we're sitting. If we can realize that this mirror is simply reflecting and that anything we're bringing is going to be reflected, and we're aware of what we're bringing, then little by little we're able to cease bringing so much and maybe cease bringing hardly anything or anything. And then what happens? Well, what happens if we can drop all the stuff we're bringing is just, it's just the mirror. It's that consciousness itself that we encounter, which is not a mystical, mysterious thing. It's something that's always there functioning. You can call it mystical, or you can call it deep, or you can call it whatever you want. But the fact is that it isn't a thing. It isn't subject to our human value system, and it isn't really describable. It's just that mirror itself, the mirroring effect itself, consciousness itself, in the mirroring function of it. So a lot of the time when we approach something like this, it seems very complex, and it seems like we need a lot of different steps and everything to get there. But if we can just in any given moment drop the stuff we're bringing, then that's just what's there. It's just naturally there. It's kind of like if you fall on the floor is there and it hurts, because the floor is there. And when you fall on it, it's harder than you are. You don't, well, you might get angry at the floor, but it's not going to help. The floor is not after you. The ground is just there. If you can't stand up on it and you fall, then it's not the ground's fault that you're injured. It's your, and it's not even your fault per se, it just happens. No sense in blaming the ground. So just naturally this state exists. It's functioning all the time. It never is not functioning. So applying it, when we apply it, this notion, this idea to different things, this experience to different things in our life, that's when we can really see how valuable it can be to see things this way. You know, if you look at relationships, as I was just saying, with a person, for instance, in this way, then we can see that this person is mirroring something. Because right now, if I'm seeing you, you're a reflection of that consciousness on some level. And so what's being reflected back at me is the perception of the other being on some level or another. And depending on how much I'm willing to drop my own perspective, drop my own position, I might actually be able to learn something from that reflection. Because no matter how expansive I think I am or how much I've experienced in my life, the fact is that I still have a limited view in some sense. Al as a person has a limited view by the nature of the person, personhood of selfhood. It's limited. And so others can help us expand that view, provided we are allow ourselves to be illuminated by that particular reflection. So in the case of what, when Dogen says, you know, to study the way, to study the self is to forget the self, and to forget the self is to be awakened by all things, that's what he's talking about. When we drop the self, meaning I can't drop, if I drop the body, it means I'm dead. You know, I really drop the body. So what he's not talking about dying in a physical sense. He's talking about dropping the viewpoint that this is a separate self, or self, what we call self-consciousness, When self-consciousness is fully dropped, then what do we experience? The self of everything else out there. It's pretty simple. It's not complicated, it's not even difficult, to be honest. It's not difficult, but it is difficult for most because we put layers of delusion and all these five poisons end up being layered on top of stuff. And that's where we get confused. So in the case of a flower, for instance, if we're able to drop our idea of what the flower is, what's left? The flower. If we're able to drop our idea of what it is. And the problem is, when we see certain things a lot, we tend to start relying on our ideas about them more and more. And so we don't spend the moment it might take to drop those ideas and see, what is this? Just what is this independent of my idea of it? Well, that's the miraculous thing. When we talk about, you know, we don't need any psychic phenomena, we don't need any, you know, wild out there experience. It's just, this is wild enough, you know, what this insect or this flower or this thing looks like, because I'm not conditioned by my ideas about it. It's like the way a child views it, a young child. There's many teachings in different traditions of the notion of your mind, of embracing that mind, of being like a child, right? They're not talking about not being an adult in adult relationships. They're talking about the notion of dropping ideas so that you can see things as they are in kind of a fresh new way without bringing a lot of conditioning to it. Now, all of us do this to some extent or another. The question is, to what degree do we want to go deeper into it? And this notion that I'm talking about of this mirror wisdom of consciousness as being like that, reflecting like that, is a really powerful way, if we start to work with it, that we can do that, that we can see more and more of our life experience in that way. So suffering is self-created because we're bringing certain elements into a situation that cause suffering. That's how suffering's created. It's not created by magic or for no reason. There's always a reason. The reason is, what am I bringing? Again, we have to ask ourselves, what am I bringing? Am I bringing anger, pride, jealousy, and all this other stuff? Then I'm going to suffer, period. There is suffering inherent in these poisons. Not saying you can suffer as much as you want. I'm not saying that it's good or bad. You may choose to suffer. It's all about free will when it gets right down to it. It's the ultimate free will. You can choose to do whatever you want in this given moment, but the reality is that will be reflected back, and it has differing effects depending on what you choose to bring. By choice, I mean anything you bring, because even things that we're bringing unconsciously, we're choosing on some level to bring them. We often just don't realize what that choice, when that choice was made or what that choice is, but we are choosing to bring it on some level. So you could say this is an advanced practice, because if you haven't had some practice behind you, it's easy to view this as blaming, like blaming me for bringing this to this situation. And it's not really like that at all. It's not a value judgment on what anyone's bringing. It's just saying the results differ. And really, if you look at the earliest teachings of the Buddha, he's talking about results. It's all about results. It's about, if you do this and this and this, these are the results. But if you do this and this and this, these are the results. And it's very complex, but if you just look at our everyday life situations, you see that it all gets down to, what am I bringing now to this? Am I bringing anger? If so, what's created by anger? Am I bringing clarity and openness? If so, what's created by bringing clarity and openness to a situation? Well, we all know. That's no mystery either. So in order to get the level of control to do this, that's where the incremental practice is important. Because we can't usually, I don't know anyone actually who's able to just do this from the very beginning. We need training in order to understand what we're bringing. Otherwise, we don't get. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, I don't understand why I can't blah, blah, blah. So what are they bringing? They're bringing delusion, right? Delusion's not ignorance, by the way. It's a different thing. It's not just saying you're an idiot. You're not stupid because you don't understand. You're just deluded as to what is the reality. I don't understand why I'm doing this particular thing means that I haven't gotten a handle, essentially, on why I'm doing this. It's something from my past. It's a conditioned response from my past. Probably started very early. In my experience, most of them do. We're not that different than we were when we were five, in most cases, in terms of how we react to things. That's the problem. And a five-year-old's not an adult. This feeds and clothes millions of psychotherapists, by the way. And some Zen teachers. Not millions, but a few.
Yeah.
And priests and life coaches and coaches and self-help gurus, regular gurus. It feeds all of us. Thank you. I feel like that giant plant that feed me. What was that? Little Shop of Horrors.
Speaking of that.
Uh-oh. I don't know where it's.
No, so the workshop that you're going to be doing, can you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm going to be doing, I'm kind
Thank
of.
Thank you for asking that question.
Yeah, I was going to say it a little later. Well, I.
What's he feeding you?
I'm going to do. I'm going to, this talk was kind of a prelude to the workshop I'm doing. I'm doing one here and one in Naples. The one here is going to be October 19th, where we're going to spend a day doing some practices to kind of work on this, work with this. And some of them will be, you know, internal practices, and some of them will be with other people, working with other people. So everything's the mirror. It's an easy workshop to put together. Since everything's the mirror, you can really do anything. You know, you could play with, maybe we should do that, play with Play-Doh. You could do Play-Doh things and see what you're bringing to the Play-Doh. I never thought of that one, but that'd be fun. Yeah.
I didn't really follow the, it'd be easy to see blame. Followed everything you said except for, you know, that.
Did anyone understand what I was talking about there?
Yeah.
Anyone who's been in that state, how did you see it? That idea.
Well, actually, as you were saying it, I was thinking that exact same thing, because it's like you can say, oh, well, that was the projection, and so then it's easy to interpret
right.
That that person and I.
Yeah, if judgment enters into it, either your self-judgment or judging others, you can blame, you can say, well, you're suffering because you're bringing blah, blah, blah to this situation, which on some level is true. But when we approach, that's where the non-judgmental awareness of mindfulness training really helps. This notion that we're viewing a situation without judgment to the greatest degree possible, then it just is what it is. There's not necessarily blame there. That, how a person works with this material is very individual. Everyone has to determine for themselves, is this skillful, valuable? Do I want the results of this to continue, or do I want to change the results of this, meaning I want different results? Usually when people come to Zen practice, they want different results. They don't like the results they're getting.
So the training part, I was thinking, well, you need about as much training as your talk today. I think the hard part is remembering to apply it.
Yeah.
just rip.
No, absolutely. Remembering is a good way of putting it.
Remember, what are you bringing to the situation or something?
Well, that's why I remind myself when I sit down. It's the koan I've been working with lately is, what am I bringing right now?
Yeah.
But I've been applying it in other situations. I found it really valuable. You know, like, something comes up, a financial issue or an emotional issue or a relationship issue, and then if I sit with it for a moment and think, what am I bringing to it in this exact moment? It's really interesting to start seeing, what am I bringing? Am I pissed off right now? Am I fearful? Am I feeling I want to get something, you know, from this situation? What am I bringing? There's nothing wrong with bringing stuff necessarily. It doesn't mean anything in and of itself. It's a matter of what results being created by what I'm bringing. Is that what I want? You know, all of the precepts in Buddhism are oriented towards, they're very results oriented also. I've actually never thought about this notion until just a minute ago, but they're all very result, they're all very transactional. Even though they're not necessarily stated that way, they're stated, I'm vowing not to be angry, or I'm vowing not to take what is not given, or I'm vowing to do this or that. Because early on, when people looked at this, they saw that those were the things that tended to cause suffering, and since Buddhism is essentially about relieving suffering, that do these things, and guess what? You don't suffer as much. It's not that hard. Do other stuff and you usually suffer more. Not that difficult. We all know what the things are that cause suffering for us, and we all know the things that tend to relieve it. It is not mysterious. I would say, you know, there are some people who don't seem to know that well, and occasionally maybe we don't. I know I haven't at times in my past. But the clearer we get, the more we can see, oh yeah, I know what the result of this is, very likely. So maybe just change the result by bringing something different to the mirror. Yes?
I think it's really fascinating because, being a teacher, I have over 500 mirrors.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is great. And it's,
and they're child mirrors too, right?
Child
a little
mirrors.
Different kind
it's
of mirror
kind of
than
interesting
adults.
Interesting what you were saying with the younger kids. I've had a lot more success this year. And I think because they're able to have that vision of things that are less encumbered, that makes sense. And then I'm struggling with my fourth graders, which are a little bit older, and they're big classes, so there's 26 little mirrors. And I just had an image right now in my head of when I'm in front of the class, when I feel like I'm grasping for control.
Uh-huh.
And I think what makes sense is, you know, if I'm looking at it as a reflection on myself, I've got all these things that I'm trying to juggle in the mirror, and I'm just failing. They're falling.
Yeah.
You know,
it's hard to juggle 26 things or more in the mirror.
It's nice to put that into that perspective.
Yeah.
So I can know I think what it is I'm trying to address all 26 at once.
Uh-huh.
I need to maybe slow down and focus.
Yeah. So again, what am I bringing? You know, maybe I'm bringing too much.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't need to bring as much in this given moment. Or maybe I don't need to bring this idea that I have to control it all so much, too. I mean, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
It doesn't work in all circumstances, but maybe in a particular circumstance it might, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, children are great mirrors. I remember, I'll never forget, you know how you remember certain things in school, in elementary school, just because they were events that really stuck in your mind. I remember in sixth grade, and this teacher, and she was actually a very good teacher, and my mom was a teacher for 25 years, so I'm really sympathetic to teachers, because I lived with a teacher for all those years, and so she went through. But this teacher, she was a woman who was married to a man who'd been one of the early Navy rescue guys, you know, which was a very elite group back then. I mean, this is when I was in sixth grade, so this is a long time ago. And now there's, you know, that whole program's a lot more developed. Back then, there weren't many guys in it. But she would kind of brag about her husband to this group of sixth graders, and all the guys were just, we were just, you know, that the arrogance that was apparent, because we were mirroring her arrogance, and what it mirrored for us is disdain. you know, because for us sixth grade boys, to over promote yourself was like one of the worst things you could do. You always had to understate. This was just, we had a little gang of guys, and woe to the guy who tried to say too much about himself. It just wasn't done. This was one of the rules of the gang, you know. There's rules to every cult and every gang, and this was one of the rules of ours. And you didn't want to be the guy who stuck up like that, because you'd get beaten down if you did. So when it came up in a classroom, and she was just proud of her husband, I'm sure, you know, but the way it came across to us, so that's what we were mirroring, right? And so she kind of had trouble with not so much me, I think, in this class, but a few other guys, and I know that that's where it was coming from, that they were mirroring back. It was, what button was being pushed in them, you know? Whatever we're mirroring pushes buttons in everyone else of some sort or another, maybe very mildly, maybe really intensely. And all of us have the experience of someone that just pushes that big red button that drives us berserk, you know. Sometimes in a positive sense, sometimes in a negative sense. That big red button is just bonk, and every time we see them, bonk. You know, they may not even be aware.
Are you talking about me?
Yes, actually.
Yes, he is.
I am talking about.
What are you mirroring?
Yes.
What I've been, what you're talking about lately, since I decided to